Thank you. It seems that our speakers are collectively identifying a number of ways in which we can all become seriously dead in the 21st century unless the policy is adjusted in an appropriate way. Our next speaker is Mac Owens, who I first got to know of 15 or so years ago when he was a staff member of the Senate. Alas, in those days, we enjoyed a suite of Republican senators who were on a more favorable part of the demographic distribution. But nevertheless, I know he's benefited a lot from his service in the Senate, and I think now will give us an opportunity to look a little further up the food chain of organization on how the 21st century is likely to spin out. Mac?
The first thing I'd like to say is I'm Mac Owens, and I'm from the Naval War College. I'm a professor of war, which I guess makes me a member of the War Party, Newport, Rhode Island branch. And actually, what I'm going to be talking about here is going to be related, I think, to the question that was asked this morning. Before I get into that, I'd like to, you know, add what I know a number of other speakers have said earlier, which is that I'm very honored to be before this group. It's a great group. I came a long time ago one time when Margot Carlisle invited me, and I'm sorry that I haven't had the opportunity to get back until now, but I'm glad to be here. Thank you very much for this opportunity. I take as the text for my sermon here an op-ed that appeared in my hometown paper, the Providence Journal, last week by one Mark Weisbrot. I don't know who he is. He's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington. And the title in our paper was Time U.S. Downsized Imperial Expectations. And he starts out, of course, discussing the situation in China. But it has raised some serious and long overdue questions about our foreign policy in the post-Cold War era. Does the United States really need to police the whole world? Because if we're going to remain committed to this job, we can expect more involvement in incidents of this kind, not to mention wars and other violent conflicts. He goes down to say, basically, we have enough problems here at home, is normally the prevailing sentiment among the citizenry when the questions of overseas intervention is raised. But our foreign policy establishment, the politicians, think tanks, and many intellectuals and journalists remain attached to the idea of America ruling the world. Now, I don't know that much about that organization. That sounds, the rest of the article sounds pretty much like a liberal organization that you used to see much during the Cold War, which blamed the United States pretty much for everything that happened in the world. But it's notable that this is not a right-left issue. It is an issue that affects folks on the among conservatives. An argument for disengagement has been made very articulately by the Cato Institute, people like Ted Galen Carpenter and Doug Bandow and others, who argue for strategic independence, disengagement, or whatever. But actually, you can go all the way back to Jean Kirkpatrick in the early 1990s, when she wrote an article that said, while the United States had performed heroically in a time when heroism was required, the day had passed when America ought to bear such unusual burdens. With return to normal times, she said, the United States could become a normal nation. Now, it occurred to me as, you know, I look at things like this, that this is not a new debate. It goes back a very long time. As a matter of fact, in a speech of 25 June 1787 at the Federal Convention, Charles Pinckney of South Carolina said something along these same lines. We have unwisely considered ourselves as the inhabitants of an old instead of a new country. We have adopted the maxims of a state full of people and manufacturers and established in credit. We have deserted our true interest and instead of applying closely to those improvements in domestic policy which would have ensured the future importance of our commerce, we have rashly and prematurely engaged in schemes as extensive as they are imprudent. Our true situation appears to me to be this. a new extensive country containing within itself the materials for forming a government capable of extending to its citizens all the blessings of civil and religious liberty, capable of making them happy at home. And he goes on for some time based on this theme. But several days later in the convention, Alexander Hamilton replied to him this way. He said, "It has been said that respectability in the eyes of foreign nations was not the object at which we aimed, that the proper object of republican government was domestic tranquility and happiness. This was an ideal distinction. No government could give us tranquility and happiness at home which did not possess sufficient stability and strength to make us respectable abroad." So this, as I say, is not a new argument. What I wanted to talk about today is basically what I call a grand strategy for the United States. And that's the sort of thing I do up at the Naval War College. But I want to spend a little bit of time talking about some strategic alternatives. First thing to say about strategy is it's absolutely necessary if a country is going to have a focus in its foreign policy. It has to have some idea of what it's doing, it has to have some idea of what it wants to do, and it has to be able to relate that to what's available. So you can say that strategy serves three general purposes. First, it relates ends, the goals of policy, therefore interests and objectives, to the limited resources available to achieve them. Secondly, strategy contributes to the clarification of the ends of policy by helping establish priorities in light of constrained resources. Without establishing priorities among competing ends, all interests and all threats will appear equal. In the absence of strategy, planners will find themselves in a situation described by Frederick the Great. He who attempts to defend too much defends nothing. Finally, strategy conceptualizes resources as means in support of policy. Resources are not means until strategy provides some understanding of how they will be organized and employed. This is the logical link between strategy and force planning. Defense budgets and manpower are resources. A strategic vision helps to transform those raw resources into such military means as divisions, wings, and fleet. Strategy is indispensable because without it, something else will fill a void. In war, service doctrines will dominate the concept of operations and so forth, as was the case in Vietnam. In peace, defense planning becomes dominated by what Sam Huntington has called structural. Time, it has become the practice to employ strategy more broadly so that one can speak of levels of strategy in both peace and war. Accordingly, strategy can be seen, understood not only to apply the application of force in war, but also to steps taken during peacetime to enhance national power in order to prevent war or win war should become necessary. Thus, in the words of Edward Meade Earle, strategy is the art of controlling and utilizing the resources of a nation or coalition of nations, including its armed forces, to the end that its vital interest shall be effectively promoted and secured against enemies' actual potential or merely presumed. The highest type of strategy, sometimes called grand strategy, is that which so integrates the policies and armaments of the nation that resort to war is either rendered unnecessary or is undertaken with the maximum chance of victory. And although it may be difficult, it is necessary to construct a generally accepted grand strategic design, a framework for establishing priorities, choosing a strategic approach, and allocating the resources necessary to implement the chosen strategy. In the absence of such a framework, responses are all too often incoherent and reactive, and resources are allocated on the basis of short-term parochial interests rather than long-term national ones. A grand strategy can be envisioned as an answer to a series of interrelated questions. The first of these is, What are our interests? What is it we want to accomplish in the world? What are the conditions that policymakers wish to prevail in the world? What security environment is most in accord with the interests of the United States? What steps should be taken in order to achieve these conditions? What plan of action is most likely to bring about the desired conditions? What combination of the instruments of power best supports the chosen strategic alternative? What are the opportunity costs and risks associated with the preferred strategic alternative. Now, the clearest articulation and probably the most basic articulation of American interest is peace and security. And it seems to be very clear that the one that is going to, the world order that's going to achieve that is going to be a liberal world order. Not a liberal world order as we understand liberalism these days, but 19th century world order. Liberal in the sense, basically, of free trade and general prosperity and peace. One characterized by economic liberalism and an expanding number of representative liberal democracies. Now, there are a number of alternatives. They go by different names. But one of the first of these, I guess, could be called strategic disengagement. That's the one that's advocated often by the Cato Institute and others. I don't use the word isolationism because isolationism has become a term of opprobrium, and it is frequently thrown about at anybody that you think disagrees with your approach. The Clinton administration was very good at that. Anybody that disagreed with their foreign policy was denounced as an isolationist. But basically, strategic disengagement suggests there's no justification for intervention abroad. Threatened states have an economic wherewithal to defend themselves either alone or in combination with others. Interventionism abroad is itself the source of most security problems, goes the argument. Were the U.S. to stand aloof from the squabbles of others, it would not attract the attention of others. The strong try to deter the United States, the weak to seduce it, the dispossessed to blame it. This reasoning applies in spades to terrorism, which is an asymmetrical response to the use of power abroad, U.S. power abroad. While strategic disengagement is seductive, it makes a number of unwarranted assumptions. First among these is the assumption that the natural condition of the world is peace and prosperity, and that if the U.S. were to disengage, the other players would not try to fill the vacuum. It is very likely that the disengagement of the United States would unleash military competition as potential hegemons vie for regional dominance. Countries heretofore defended by the United States would feel compelled to arm, and in many regions previously characterized by relative peace and prosperity, for instance, Western Europe and East Asia, the security dilemma would manifest itself again as arms racing and possibly preemptive war. If prosperity depends on stability, and stability depends on some level of security, a U.S. retreat would in all likelihood lead to a less secure and less prosperous world. The second approach might be called selective engagement. Now, advocates of selective engagement share many of the assumptions of the folks who advocate strategic disengagement, that because of geography and nuclear weapons, the United States is an extraordinarily secure state. However, the primary focus of selective engagement is prevention of war among the great powers, those states possessing the preponderance of industrial and military potential. So one of the big questions among advocates of selective engagement is the degree to which the United States should intervene in the periphery, in the developing world, and so forth. And the argument is that since our resources are limited, we ought not to do much of that at all. Again, as with the strategic disengagement, there are a number of problems with this approach. The first arises from its realist roots. Selective engagement posits a strategic logic based on emotionless calculations of power politics. Regime questions have little bearing on the practice of strategy. Such an approach is alien in the U.S. political tradition. Another problem arises from the fact that in ignoring a great deal of the world, selective engagement creates the same sort of vacuum that strategic disengagement does. Those areas of the globe not selected by the United States will be characterized by instability, leading to the same outcome as strategic disengagement. Some advocates of selective engagement stipulate that certain parts of the periphery are so important to the security of the core, for instance, the Persian Gulf, that the U.S. must be willing to intervene there. But there are no clear rules that delineate the more important parts of the periphery from the less important. Selective engagement gives its least precise positive guidance on matters that matters most commonly figure prominently in the media and hence in the public debate on the U.S. foreign policy. Far from simplifying foreign policy choices, selective engagement in practice will require extended public debate on each alternative. Then there's something called cooperative security, going beyond collective security to the idea that you can use preventive diplomacy basically to achieve these this level of cooperation among states. The idea is that the world is ripe for such a system. The end of the Cold War and the apparent triumph of liberal political and economic principles provides a rare window of opportunity for cementing a cooperative system into place. Additionally, the instruments necessary to the success of cooperative security are available. The increasing importance and reach of international institutions, the development of preventive diplomacy, the existence of a mature arms control regime, decisive military technological superiority in the hands of the United States. Now, you know, the biggest response to this sort of argument is to suggest that we become complacent sometimes and somehow think that when there's essentially peace at hand, that is going to be the situation that's going to prevail forever and ever and ever. And I would remind you only that the last time the world was as interdependent as it is now was in 1914. And you may recall this quote from The World Crisis by Churchill, when he, in 1921, mocked the sort of fatuous optimism as it manifests itself during the Agadir Crisis of 1911. And he wrote, "War is too foolish, too fantastic to be thought of in the 20th century. Civilization has climbed above such perils. The interdependence of nations in trade and traffic, the sense of public law, the Hague Convention, liberal principles, the Labor Party, high finance, Christian charity, common sense have rendered such nightmares impossible. Are you quite sure? It would be a pity to be wrong." As Donald Kagan has observed, history seems to indicate that, quote, "the goodwill, unilateral disarmament, the avoidance of alliance, teaching and preaching the evils of war by those states who seek to preserve peace are to no avail. What seems to work best is the possession of those states who wish to preserve peace, the predominant power, and of the will to accept the burdens of and responsibility required to achieve that power." And that's called primacy. And as you might assume, I'm an advocate of primacy. Primacy holds that the key to future peace and prosperity for the United States is to maintain its position after the Cold War. The central purpose of primacy is preventing the emergence of a potential new rival along the lines of the former Soviet Union. But economically and politically, primacy is based on hegemonic stability theory, which holds that fundamental international trade based on liberal principles of comparative advantage and the division of labor does not just occur through the activities of a global invisible hand. Instead, economic openness only arises in the presence of hegemonic power, a state willing and able to provide the world with the collective good of economic stability and international security. A state will only adopt the leadership role of hegemon when it is in its national interest to do so. In short, the theory of hegemonic stability rests on two propositions. Order in a world politics is typically created by a single dominant power, and the maintenance of order requires continued hegemony. According to the theory of hegemonic stability, decline in relative U.S. power could create a more or less peaceful world. A precedent for the United States is the decay of Pax Britannica, which many believe created the necessary, if not sufficient, conditions for the two world wars of the 20th century. As British hegemony declined, smaller states that previously had incentives to cooperate with her defected to other powers, causing the international system to fragment. The outcome was depression and war. It does matter who is the dominant power in the world. Now, of course, critics claim that it is futile for the United States to pursue primacy for several reasons. First, it's the economic system. Technological requirements are too great. Second, despite the fact that U.S. hegemony is qualitatively different from hegemonies of the past in that it eschews territorial conquest, U.S. power, benevolent as it may be, is likely to engender resentment on the part of other states, anti-hegemonic alliances. Finally, there's the temptation of what Paul Kennedy calls imperial overstretch. There may be a tendency to argue that if a certain level of power is good, more power is better. And at some point, you simply overstretch. The final objection to primacy is it requires a level of public commitment that may not be possible to achieve in a democratic society in the absence of an identifiable threat. The important thing I think to keep in mind here is that the argument that, again, if the United States were to pull back, the world would likely become more rather than less stable or unstable, and that we would have to worry about the possibility at some point then of bailing that world out. I just, if you think that 3% or 3.5% of GDP is too much to spend on defense, consider these numbers. U.S. defense spending was nearly 10 times greater than what we proposed during the peak years of World War II. 38.6% of GDP in 1943, 39.9% in 1994, and 40% in 1995, not to mention the 280,000 dead and many maimed. And it just gets back to an argument that basically says that Great Britain's great failure at the end of the 19th century is not imperial overstretch, but was their inability to prevent a war that they then had to fight, and which was the cause then of the decline of the British Empire. And I'll stop at that point, and we can talk about questions later on. Thank you very much.